which is the healthcare exchange. Senator Lurie moves adoption of the division report. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. And we've got the division engrossment in front of us, and we'll work from that. So, Senator Lurie.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. As you stated, we have the Senate File 1 in front of us, which establishes a health insurance exchange as required under the Federal Affordable Care Act. An exchange is really just an online portal where Minnesotans can compare on an apples-to-apples basis and purchase health insurance. The exchange is also the only venue where low- and middle-income Minnesotans can access the new federal tax credits and cost-sharing subsidies to help reduce the costs of their health care coverage. I will be focusing my bill overview on the sections of this bill that are within the jurisdiction of this committee. Those include the financing structure, which is currently in the Senate, the health impact fee, the establishment of a state-funded navigator program, and the fiscal costs related to the Department of Commerce, the Department of Health, and the Department of Human Services. So jumping into the bill, sections 3 and 4 cover that financing structure, again, the health impact fee.
Well, so, Lori, for people who haven't heard the bill, why don't you give us a little bit of a background on the bill? You gave the kind of the general introduction, but a little bit more detail on the bill in terms of what it's meant to accomplish and how it does that.
Sure. Well, again, this is the establishment of the Minnesota Health Insurance Exchange. This bill, Senate File 1, this is my eighth committee stop with this bill, and so many of us have heard it already and had much more detailed conversations about it. Really, it sets up Minnesota Health Insurance Exchange under the Affordable Care Act. Again, the alternative is to allow the feds to come in and set up their one-size-fits-all. And with Minnesota being a national leader historically on health care, it makes sense to do that using the Minnesota model. So this creates a board in the executive branch with 7 members, 3 appointed to represent consumers that will be accessing coverage on the exchange, 3 experts from the healthcare field, and the commissioner of the Department of Human Services to oversee this new online marketplace that is intended to have healthcare insurance options available for consumers so that, again, they can compare on an apples-to-apples basis those products to best fit their needs and make the right selection. Estimates are that by 2016, 1.3 million Minnesotans will be gaining their insurance coverage through using this marketplace, the exchange. 700,000 of those will be gaining access through the Medicaid portion, and really importantly, 300,000 of them are currently uninsured. And if we do a good job with some other work that's going on, establishing a basic health plan, we could actually reduce the uninsured rolls by an additional 45,000 are the estimates. So it's really the online portal. There will be in-person assisters and navigators. Folks that can't access the internet or have trouble with it will have other methods of making sure that they can use this exchange to, again, comparison shop and find the right product to meet their needs. Individuals, small employers, that's the intent of this bill.
So, Senator Lurie, if I can ask, so you've mentioned some figures in terms of people who would access the exchange. If things work out to the optimum, where would Minnesota be then in terms of percentages as to folks who have insurance versus what kind of population would you expect to be not covered by anything?
Well, currently today, Minnesota has about 9% uninsured. It's about 500,000 Minnesotans. And as I said, about 300,000 of the current uninsured under the structure of this bill would eventually find coverage by 2016 through the exchange. That's the estimates that we have before us. Again, In future bills, we've been working together to try to preserve a Minnesota Care type model to fit and within the exchange context, and that would be if that goes well, we could reduce the uninsured rolls by an additional 45,000. So we're going to be somewhere between 155,000 uninsured and 200,000 uninsured still after 2016, when the exchange is starting to reach its maturity and stabilize a little bit.
Okay, so obviously we hope this works. So it's a little bit premature then, but who comprises the roughly 150 to 200,000 that might be left uninsured after 2016?
I'm going to ask somebody from the exchange office to come up and help me through some of these.
Sure.
I think it's largely folks that are unable to access because of their legal status here, but there may be a couple of other populations as well.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is April Todd Mumlove. I'm the exchange director. Of the 200,000 that would be remaining uninsured, as Senator Lurie mentioned, some of them are undocumented that are in the state. But there are others that will just choose not to have coverage. They will choose to pay the penalty, the tax penalty, instead of having coverage. Some of them, as people are today, some people are eligible for medical assistance and they choose not to enroll. So we will still have individuals that, through their choice, choose not to enroll coverage.
And what happens if somebody doesn't have access to a computer?
Mr. Chair, I said there we'll have navigators, in-person assisters, a call center, robust set of options to assist individuals that either choose not to or don't have access to a computer.
So there is there's some type of telephone?
Absolutely, and that's a core federal requirement that there be telephone access, and then people in the community as well that'll be able to sit in person with individuals and help them through these choices.
And just another general question for either of you, but what's the intersection then between the Federal Health and Human Services Department and our exchange?
Well, our exchange will be the manner in which individuals in Minnesota are able to gain access to the advanced premium tax credits and the cost-sharing reductions that flow through the federal government. And so there has to be a communication between the two to ensure that eligibility work is done properly, and that's what Minnesota's exchange will be doing, is creating the marketplace where consumers can comparison shop, and then also making sure that the eligibility works to bring the federal supports in to help individuals reduce the cost of those premiums and the cost-sharing arrangements that they have through the product that they purchased.
Okay, thanks. Senator Champion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the testifier, Senator, I know that this is going to be an online portal, and you talked a little bit about navigators and access in various communities. Can you just briefly indicate to me who's going to make the determination as to the system of navigators and where those navigators will be?
For year one, the Commissioner of the Department of Minnesota Management and Budget, MMB, within 30 days of enactment, will have the first year's navigator and in-person assister policies and procedures promulgated, and it'll largely be done through our existing MNCA program, which is the Minnesota Community Application Agents program run through the Department of Human Services. Those are the folks in the community today that are helping people gain access to Minnesota Care and Medicaid and our public assistance program. So we're trying not to recreate the wheel in year one, but in year two, the exchange board itself will adopt the rules about how we contract with the in-person assisters and the navigators. And, you know, likely it'll be those same entities. In last week's or this week's, I guess it was. I don't know what day. No, last week's hearing at Human Services, we had the Community Action Partnership, the CAP agencies come in and talk about their desire to function well. We had the Urban League come in. We had the AIDS Project come in and talk about their desire to fill this role, and all of those would be eligible for participation to come in and contract. So we're looking at trusted community resources that have the cultural and linguistic capabilities to really engage at the community level and help people understand their options. And again, initially, we're going to use the MNCA program that has been quite successful, although a little bare bones in year one, and we're going to, you know, ramp it up and make it function a little bit better. And then in year two, the Exchange Board will be in charge of making those contracts work to do that community outreach. It's a critical piece of the work, and it's well recognized that for the success of the Exchange, that outreach to these historically uninsured, underserved populations is absolutely critical. That's what, you know, that's what we're all working toward here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Lurie.
So, with that, you know, brief discussion, I'll jump in and cover the sections. I'll try to do it rather quickly and then open it up to more questions. Section 3 and 4 are the financing structure in the Senate today. It's the health impact fee again. Generally, federal law requires that state exchanges be financially self-sustaining by 2015. And this bill uses the health impact fee to finance its operations. The way that works is that by April 30th of each year, the board will certify to MMB the estimated costs necessary to fund the operations of the exchange for the next fiscal year, and MMB will make those funds available. Section 9, Subdivision 4, covers this navigator program we were just talking about. Generally, under federal law, Minnesota must establish and fund a navigator program that will be mostly through grants. Again, for the first year, 2014 only, the navigator program will be met through the MNCA program at DHS, and MMB will adopt the rules for that within 30 days of enactment, and that's required to meet our blueprint deadline with the feds, that 30 days after enactment. But then the board has the requirement to establish the policies and procedures for the ongoing operations of the navigator and customer service provisions, again, beginning in 2015. Funding for the operations of the marketplace shall cover any compensation provided to navigators in the navigator program. And all entities eligible to serve as navigators are able to apply to be the in-person assisters and can be compensated for services not paid for as navigators elsewhere. The fiscal note assumes that 75% of small businesses and 25% of individuals using the exchange will use an insurance broker for assistance in finding the right place for them. Of the remaining individuals and small businesses gaining coverage through the exchange, it's assumed that about a third of them will use this navigator program. And so that assumption yields about $105 per enrollee using the navigators. And it's also important to note that counties will continue their current role in funding for the medical assistance program for eligibility determinations, ongoing case management, and call center assistance. The fiscal implications for DHS are found in Section 9, Subdivision 8. They generally require the board to establish and maintain an agreement with the Commissioner of Human Services for cost allocation and services regarding eligibility determinations and enrollment for public health care programs and other services. And the fiscal note assumes that the legislature would only appropriate the state share of these cost-allocated Medicaid costs to DHS. This analysis also assumes that the appropriations to DHS would be transferred into and spent out of the DHS major systems account in the existing special revenue fund.
So, Senator, do you have some sense of the cost as to what's going to be taken from the fund?
There's in 2016, and typically when I talk about fiscal costs off the top of my head, I go to 2016 just for members' reference because that's when the exchange starts to stabilize. The costs of the Medicaid allocable costs are about $10 million a year for the cost allocated portion of a Medicaid expense.
So do you have any sense of the dollars?
$10 million.
Ten is the?
Is the cost allocated portion.
For 2016?
For 2016.
So I'm sorry, I didn't, my question wasn't, I didn't clarify my own question. So what would you expect over, say, the several years subsequent to 2016?
Well, 2016 is where it's starting to stabilize. I think that's a pretty good benchmark. It'll probably, you know, the Medicaid side will probably stay relatively stable. It might grow a little bit, but 2016's getting to a pretty stable point for the Medicaid population.
And if I forget what the demography is in terms of projected population growth, but I think it's somewhere 2.5% a year, I'm not sure, for the state. So if we assume between, say, hypothetically 2016 and 2021, over the five-year period, we have another 250,000 people in the state, 300,000 people in Minnesota. Do we assume that that amount remains stable?
Well, it will grow. It's not just individuals, it's also the economy. I mean, as you know, and so those are difficult things to project terribly into the future. Our fiscal note only goes to 2017. Hopefully the economy will be doing better and we'll have fewer Medicaid enrollees. It's hard to project a great deal further than that. But when the exchange is stable, you know, in the economy that's expected in 2016, it's about $10 million of Medicaid allocable costs. In 2017, I think it grows less than $1 million. And that's as far as we take the projections. You know, I can ask for more detail into, 10 years down the road if you want. But
I'm just curious if I recognize that it's difficult to project, 10 years, 20 years, 30 years. But what happens if hypothetically we have another recessionary period as we've just gone through, and we have an economy that is flatlined, or if there's even negative GDP growth? Do we make that up if we assume then that figure is not a stable figure? Do we then have the ability to make that up?
Mr. Chair, I mean, you've hit upon one of the struggles we live with every day in the health and human services world, is that when the economy takes the slightest tick downwards and our state revenues begin to decline, and the need for the programs we provide for folks needing assistance goes up in a counter-cyclical manner.
So even with the establishment of the exchange, depending on where economic growth is or is not, you'd see an increase and or decrease in, say, the medical assistance enrollees. And so it's not going to be any different in that regard than what we face today or 2-3 years ago.
That would be a correct statement.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair.
Chair Madoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Lurie, you mentioned that $10 million would be the cost associated with implementing the Medicaid population. What is that? What is the total cost if you put in the same year? What percentage is that to the total, given you're also assuming the, individuals and small business holders?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonoff, I'm going to bring the fiscal director of the exchange up for these incredibly detailed questions. There, I just received this fiscal note, a couple of weeks ago as well, and they've been entrenched in these much deeper discussions longer than I have. So,
Ms. Julek.
Mr. Chair, Barb Julek, the fiscal director for the exchange. Senator, again, sticking with the fiscal 16 scenario that Senator Lurie, total costs are approximately $60 million, of which Medicare would be about $10 million of that.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Julek, is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Could you point me to which page in the fiscal note I can see that on?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I'm on page 17.
This is in the 2CE, so it's S0001-2CE. That should be the one that members have. There's been a lot of these.
And, Mr. Chair and members, if I may, the way the fiscal note is laid out, it looks at three different enrollment scenarios and what the cost under each of those enrollment scenarios may be. It's a high, a medium, and a low. And so what you see is starting on page 17 is a summary of the estimated budget under those scenarios. So table 21 on page 17 reflects the high enrollment scenario. Table 22 would be the medium enrollment, and then table 23, which goes on to page 18, would be a low enrollment scenario. And so within each of these tables are the summary of the various cost items, including personnel, support costs, contracts, IT, customer service, et cetera, totaling up to a total expenditure line, which you need within each table. How much of that is estimated to be allocated to Medicaid? How much would be associated with the health impact fee transfer? And then that would balance between them.
Mr. Chair.
Sir, I don't know if did you have a...
Well, Mr. Chair, I just want to say I'm assuming we'll go through the whole fiscal note, but that was just a question based on the answer to Senator Cohn, because the fiscal note is very complicated. Thank you.
And Mr. Nauman points out that apparently what's assumed is high enrollment. Is that correct? Yeah. Sir Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just wondering if we can go, or if we're planning to go through the fiscal note, because I'm already confused, because Senator Lori mentioned a $10 million number, and then we just heard a $60 million number, and that's for fiscal year 16. But equally important is fiscal years 14 and 15, what the cost is going to be specifically to the general fund, because that's the budget that we're trying to put together. So I'm just wondering, are we going to go through the fiscal note? I don't know how many committees you have dedicated to this, but there's 47 pages, and I think it's important the Finance Committee understands the fiscal note for this very important piece of legislation.
Sir Miller, I wanted to give Senator Lori the chance to make his presentation.
Okay.
And I was going to ask Mr. Albrecht to just not go through 47 pages, but to offer a more detailed sense of the fiscal note.
Okay. So, Mr. Chair, if we have questions specifically on the fiscal note, we should maybe wait on those until...
Why don't we do that? Until
we do the bill.
Let's allow Senator Lori to finish.
Thank you.
Sure. I was on the fiscal implications for the Minnesota Department of Health. Those will be found in Section 9, Subdivision 9. The bill requires that the board contract with MDH to carry out enforcement of certification requirements, and the fiscal note assumes that the marketplace will contract with MDH to provide ongoing regulatory activities beginning in January 2015. It also permits other contracts for other services with MDH and requires the board to consult with the commissioner regarding operations of the exchange. The fiscal implications for commerce are also in Section 9, Subdivision 3 here. This is regarding insurance producers and brokers. The Commissioner of Commerce shall act as a consultant to both MMB and the Exchange Board in the establishment of certification requirements for brokers who are assisting people with coverage and federal tax credits and subsidies in the exchange. The training requirements for exchange certification shall qualify for continuing ed requirements for brokers required under Chapter 60K at the Department of Commerce. And it requires health carriers who offer plans through the exchange to report in writing to the board and the Commissioner of Commerce the compensation and incentives offered to brokers for each type of health plan the carrier offers, both inside and outside the exchange, and provides that otherwise nothing in this subdivision shall limit the license requirements and regulatory functions of the Commissioner of Commerce under 60K. Also, Section 9, Subdivision 9, requires the board to establish and maintain an agreement with the Commissioner of Commerce for services regarding the enforcement of exchange certification requirements for plans offered in the exchange, and allows the board to establish other agreements with Commerce if needed for other services. Section 16.
I'm sorry, Sir Lori. Senator Anderson, did you have a...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Lori, in here in your section of the fiscal note, it says stakeholder relations and navigator / broker business. Are they synonymous, navigator and broker? Because it's basically synonymous.
No. Those are distinct pieces. The brokers are insurance producers in the statute, and they have a separate function and a historic value that they've brought to the insurance marketplace. And the bill essentially allows them to continue to operate under contract with health carriers in the manner in which they do in today's world. The Navigators and in-person assister program is really, again, in year 2014, the first year of operation, that's going to be done through our Minca program, and they're largely through grants to, you know, nonprofits, community folks, counties actually really want to, many of them would like to step up and be able to provide some of those navigator and in-person assister functions, but they are distinct functions from the brokers. One of the things that makes them distinct is that navigators and in-person assisters are not actually able to complete a transaction with an individual. They're able to give general information and make sure that people understand the way in which they can use the tools available to them, but they can't help the individual actually select a product. That's the historic role of the broker or insurance agent, and that role is protected in this bill.
Sir Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
No, I have two sentences left, and then we're done. Can I? Let me just finish up this.
All right, let's have Senator Lurie finish his presentation.
All right. I got Section 16 and 18. Section 16 provides the Commissioner of Commerce, in consultation with the Board of Directors of MCHA, with the power to develop and implement the phase-out and eventual termination of coverage under MCHA. And Section 18 provides that the Exchange Board will consult with the Commissioner of Commerce on any action taken regarding the treatment of multi-employer plans upon the release of final federal regulations addressing this issue. That's my presentation of the bill. Now I'll stand for questions.
That's good job, Senator Lurie.
Thank you.
Maybe we can just take a pause for a second and reflect on Senator Lurie.
Applause, you said?
Applause.
Oh, I was going to say, that'd be new. I haven't gotten any of that yet.
Right. Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm very pleased I had a hand in speeding him up. Senator Lurie, back to Senator Anderson's question regarding the difference between brokers and navigators. It seems to me that historically brokers, insurance brokers, did have a significant hand and input into giving guidance to folks as to what kind of insurance they needed and what kind of products were out there and so forth. Given the fact that it's at least seems to me that insurance brokers really performed the same or similar function as these proposed navigators. Why do we need navigators in addition to the brokers?
Mr. Chair, Senator Newman, the short answer would be that navigators are a federal requirement to have. The longer answer would be that, you know, insurance agents and brokers really do have a value that they bring to the industry. But they really haven't worked extensively with the populations that have really struggled to find insurance. I mean, they, you know, we have 500,000 uninsured still today, and the navigators and in-person assisters are largely tailored to reach those underserved, uninsured, you know, historic populations that have had a great deal of trouble finding affordable health care coverage. And some of these incredibly important relationships in the communities where these individuals live are going to be valuable. And it's also important to note that broker, if they choose, can function in a navigator capacity if they wish to do that, or an in-person assister. So they're distinct functions. There's the navigator and in-person assisters are going to be there to, you know, help people understand the tools that are available to them, and the insurance brokers are going to play their historic role for, you know, largely the populations that they've always served, and they're, you know, we've protected that role in this bill, and we did it with participation and consultation of the broker community, those that have been down here. I worked diligently with them to craft this in a manner in which it protected their historic role.
Sir Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick follow-up question. For that group of folks who have not been able to find insurance and have gone on uninsured or underinsured, hasn't the Department of Health and Human Services and Health and Human Services at the county level fulfilled that obligation such that we really don't need this new navigator system put into place?
Mr. Chair, Senator Newman, once again, it is a federal requirement that we have a navigator program. And, you know, the counties, this has been, you know, a role of the counties to help people gain access to Medicaid. And they will continue to play that role. That's a big piece of it. But if we want them to also help people work, you know, above the Medicaid levels to find the right product on the exchange, you know, this is a fairly modest compensation for this greatly enhanced role than what has been provided historically. And you know, I think it's a federal requirement and only fair to bring some level of compensation to help these community organizations. Counties would be one example of these organizations that will be assisting individuals navigate the tools that they have available to them. But if we don't fund that, it just won't work as well and we won't have as good of outreach.
Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Senator Lori, I keep seeing this navigator/broker, navigator/broker, broker/navigator. And you say they're two distinguished different positions, and yet they're tied together on these lines here for having funding for a navigator/broker or a broker/navigator. And if they're supposed to be separate or different, why are they put together in that manner?
Mr. Chair, Senator Anderson, maybe you could point me to the
page 11 of 47.
Okay. 11. Oh, navigator, broker, program director, and these are actually staff positions that'll be, you know, I mean, navigators and brokers are both acting to help individuals make sure that they're making the right choice for themselves, individuals and small businesses. And so, you know, these are staff at the exchange that'll be tasked with making sure that function broadly works. And so they're going to oversee the navigator program and the broker program and make sure that individuals are getting the level of service that they're asking for and that they're needing in order to, again, find the right product for them on this marketplace. So that's the sense in which those two are combined on those lines that you're discussing. It's not a combining of the funding streams.
So, Mr. Chair, on page 6 there where it says it breaks it all under business operations, the navigator/broker is, again, another staff person that you're just including as a person that's going to oversee the navigators and oversee the brokers.
That's correct.
Okay. Further general questions for – I'm sorry, Senator Westrom. I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Lori, a couple of questions you were talking about. Let me just ask a broad global one first. The federal exchange in the beginning, you said, is the default if we don't do our own Minnesota version. Can you just explain what are the differences between our version and what the federal version would allow if we don't pass one ourselves?
Senator Lori.
Well, we have a handout we could make available to members of the committee. The biggest one I keep going back to is really the price. I mean, the federal government is going to use a withhold, which was what our bill had initially, that is slated to be 3.5% of premium sold on the exchange. And in the federal model, it it's never slated to go down from that 3.5%. You know, our current funding stream is no longer the withhold, but the numbers in the fiscal note are still reflective of the general amount that was produced by a withhold. And by the end of 2016, the year I keep going to, when things level off, we're down at a 2% of premiums for products sold on the exchange. So the biggest benefit is really that we're going to be able to run a much more efficient exchange than the federal government is proposing to run. The other huge benefit of operating a Minnesota-based exchange is that, again, Minnesota has been a national leader in healthcare for decades, and we have a lot of tools and a really collaborative set of relationships with our entire healthcare and insurance community that just would not be recognized were we to go with the one size fits all federal exchange. But I can make a there's a couple of pages here regarding the differences. Those are the big ones that I keep coming back to.
So, Mr. Chair, Senator Lurie, as how the exchange functions, does that change at all? Are we offering anything new or unique, or does the federal exchange model have the same, these insurance products are listed and this is what everybody has to choose from? Do they allow more products to be listed or prescribe that every product legally offered in the state is to be on there, or do they limit it in some version or fashion, or how would the actual function potentially be different under the federal?
Mr. Chair, Senator Westrom, I think you're getting to the selection criteria. The federal Department of Health and Human Services also has the power to set certification requirements and select which plans can participate in the federal exchange. It's a very similar model to what our state-based exchange is. So the feds do have the power to select much in the same way that we have it, but theirs is not really bounded yet. They haven't adopted rules. We've worked with the health carriers here and asked them, there's a philosophical difference about whether having some tools to leverage value out of the marketplace are wise or not. I fall on the side that it is wise to have some tools to be able to empower this board to leverage value out of the marketplace. And I worked hard with the carriers on what that might look like. And what they said would work, if we needed to have this, again, I'm not saying that they're in agreement with it, but if we need to have this, what should it look like? And they proposed that we have a system whereby the board would adopt and promulgate rules that would become effective February 1st of each year that said what the certification criteria would be for participation on the exchange, that would be explicit about the measurements against which those criteria would be evaluated to help narrow the target so that carriers understood what products the board was trying to get at. And so, I think that level of additional certainty, defining the target clearly so that health carriers have advance warning of what they're supposed to be shooting at in terms of the value-based products that we're looking for on the exchange is a significant added value that has been inserted into this bill in consultation with the health carriers.
And Mr. Chair, on that point, is that not a component of the federal exchange?
The federal exchange does have the power to select carriers, and it's not yet defined very well. So, I think adding that definition, the mechanism around which that selection would be exercised, is an important facet of that the Minnesota exchange brings forward.
Mr. Chair, a couple more questions. Senator Lurie, you talked about the selection process in a prior committee environment, Jobs and Ag Committee. We reviewed this and heard from the small businesses that they're there were concern that, that products would be excluded from the selection process. Has anything been done to change that or improve that? It seems like we're not maybe running the most efficient exchange if the whole idea is to give people a one-stop shop marketplace. Any further comment on that issue? And then I want to follow back up on who's covered.
Mr. Chair, Senator Westham, there has been no changes to that provision.
There hasn't. Mr. Chair, back earlier in your introduction, the Chair asked about who will be covered when this goes through, and you said there's about 300,000 new people covered. Currently, there's about 500,000 Minnesotans that aren't covered. Is that correct?
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, Senator Lurie, you went on to say of the 155 to 200,000, some of them would be undocumented persons living here. Out of that 500,000, how many do we estimate are undocumented people living here that are currently counted in the 500,000 that are uncovered, that aren't covered with medical care? Do you know?
We can get back to you on that. It's, you know, the there's a five-year residency requirement, and so part of the 155 to 200,000 that would be left would not be able to access coverage through this mechanism, so that would be the entirety of that population would be left in the uninsured. We're not going to be bringing in individuals that aren't eligible.
So Mr. Chair, Senator Lurie, is that current law right now, or you're saying if somebody's here illegally but they're here for less than 5 years, they don't get medical coverage, but if they're here over 5 years, they do? Is that the policy now?
I'm going to bring the department up for these are federal laws. It's not actually addressed in Senate File 1. We're operating under the federal structure that is in the Affordable Care Act, in the manner in which the tax advanced premium tax credits and the cost sharing reductions are available, and we're going with the federal rules. So an exact and technical explanation of what they are, I'm going to ask Mr. Golden for that.
Okay, thank you. But they are going to certainly affect the cost of the exchange in Minnesota. Mr. Golden?
Mr. Chair, committee members, for the record, Jim Golden, Deputy Assistant Commissioner at the Department of Human Services. Under the ACA, in order to participate through the exchange, either with medical assistance or for tax credits, or even just to purchase out of your own pocket, you do need to be lawfully present. And lawfully present is either citizenship or through one of a variety of mechanisms that the federal government allows individuals into the country. So undocumented individuals would not be eligible for any type of financial assistance through the exchange, nor would they be eligible to even purchase insurance through that mechanism. In the medical assistance, you also have to be lawfully present, except for the case of emergency medical assistance, or EMA, which the legislature addressed in the last session.
And which is purely state.
Which is purely state funded.
Right.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Golden, so is there... Senator Lurie originally alluded to if they're here over 5 years, they may qualify. Is that not the case if they're illegal aliens?
Mr. Chair and Senator Westrom, simply being here 5 years does not provide you any type of eligibility because, again, the criteria is lawful presence. And so you have to be here in a lawful way. The federal government has a wide variety of mechanisms, but simply being here for a period of time is, to my knowledge, not one of those.
So, Mr. Chair, Mr. Golden, are we counting undocumented aliens or illegal aliens at all in the numbers when we say there's 155 to 200,000 left uncovered? Why would we be counting them? The number of who's not covered in our state when what you're telling us now is they really aren't supposed to be covered under this exchange. Is that right?
Maybe, Mr. Chair, Senator Westrom, maybe I'll answer that question. One of the reasons that we need to count them and acknowledge their presence is because they still show up at our providers. Our hospitals and our, you know, our entire provider community would be very upset if we just pretended they didn't exist. They're human beings that are present in our state and are going to show up at our providers. And, you know, I mean, we're not going to let them just die. Somebody's going to provide them care, be it, you know, through the EMA program. We're going to do something. I mean, pretending like they don't exist is just not good public policy. Well, and so they exist, and this is the numbers around it. That's what it is. And so, no, we're not letting anybody who isn't allowed access to this system from the feds access in Senate File 1.
So, Mr. Chair and Senator Lori, then do we also provide the phone number to the hospitals so they can call and have them deported? Or are we just going to pretend that they're here illegally? I mean, that's the other alternative. You said we aren't going to pretend that they don't exist. Well, then let's not pretend that they're here legally.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Senator Westrom, this is way beyond Senate File 1 is my main point. I mean, we're counting populations. You know, certainly if you want to have, you know, a bill regarding citizenship status, you should introduce one. We're here talking about Senate File 1. It was asked how many people will still be uninsured. The number's between 155 and 200,000.
Well, Mr. Chair, this is my last point. Senator Lori, there's a big difference about saying there's 155 to 200,000 or some number thereabouts of Minnesotans that are uninsured. That tells the citizens of Minnesota a different story than saying there's 155 to 200,000, but let's give them the footnote that says 10,000 of those or 50,000 or 100,000 of those people that choose to be uninsured or are uninsured really aren't supposed to be here and are not here legally anyways. That is a big difference.
Mr. Chair, Senator Westrom, we already said we'd follow up with that number.
All right, thanks.
Senator Dibble.
Well, thanks, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to reemphasize the point that Senator Lori made, which is there are folks living in our state, and, you know, they're undocumented. But they're living in our state nonetheless, and health issues are going to arise, and they're going to crop up, and they're going to show up at our emergency rooms. And we have to have some handle on who they are and, you know, and when they show up for medical service. Somehow or another, that medical service is going to have to be paid for. And so for us to stick our head in the sand and pretend like there aren't people in our community, by the way, are families and doing a lot of work, and we rely on a lot of their work, and not account for what are going to represent real costs to our systems, is not prudent. Now, if Senator Westrom wants to introduce a bill telling folks if they do show up, if they're bleeding in the street, and they do show up somewhere and look for medical assistance and somehow or another that they're going to be sanctioned for that, I welcome him introducing that bill, and we'll have that discussion about how we treat people humanely or how we don't treat people humanely in our state.
Well, to be fair, Senator Dibble, and this buttresses what Senator Lori said. I mean, the reality is if somebody shows up at an ER, the ER is prohibited from not treating them. They have to treat that person if they show up in the ER. And if they show up, I don't know, because they should have gotten, you know, an aspirin, that might be one thing. But it's pretty well known that emergency medical providers don't have a choice in terms of providing significant medical care. Senator Engelbrechtson.
Mr. Chair, I have the numbers now. Okay. If people want to, you know, work on them, it's of the 200,000 uninsured, 12%, 24,000 of them would be estimated to be undocumented. 36% or 72,000 would be documented but not subject to the individual mandate. They'll be getting an exemption from income or any other reasons why you might get an exemption. 43%, 86,000 individual would be subject to the mandate but choose to pay the penalty instead. And 9% or 18,000 become newly uninsured. Individuals drop coverage or employers drop coverage. You know, presumably some of that's going to be some of the churn that occurs. So
The number around that undocumented is about 12% of the 200,000.
Okay. Senator Robertson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you also for clarifying that emergency room, people coming into the emergency room, any fashion needing emergency services will never be turned away. It never has been the policy of Minnesota to turn away. Whether you have something in your pocket that says you belong someplace else, doesn't matter. They just don't. That begs the question, Senator Lori, and maybe you're not able to answer this, and maybe it isn't pertaining to this. I will get into this, a couple of pages here, but when we're on that note, by seeking insurance and having insurance on, I think the goal is to have the insurance on all Minnesotans, or the mandate, I should say, come down from the federal government, is that we have that. Is there any guarantee, and I suspect there probably isn't, that the emergency room care abuse that have cost and driven the cost of health care up in a state, and I assume probably all over the country, from folks who don't have any skin in the game, if you will, they don't pay a whole lot for their insurance, medical assistant folks, whatnot. Are they going to be, is there a mechanism that is going to be there that during triage says, no, you just got a very minor runny nose here. It's a Saturday night. The emergency room is filled with people that are really, really need some service and some help. Please go to your provider that you would go to during the day, which is going to be about a fourth or maybe even a sixth of the money. Is there any mechanism in here to help with that cost that Minnesotans have been paying over the last many years? That burdensome cost that we've been paying for those, is there any mechanism in here that would trip and help assist that? Or are we going to go just business as normal if you have that social attitude that, well, I've got this card now, I can go get my medical care any place, and, oh, by the way, it's Saturday, I can go to the emergency room. Is there anything in here at all that redirects that type of care?
Senator Lori.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ingebrigtsen, let me just say that this is one of the prefatory comments I always try to make. I didn't make it today. Senate File 1 is not health care reform. Senate File 1 is health insurance reform. This is getting people access to insurance. The issue that you bring up is a very critical one in terms of health care reform. Senate File 1 creates a health insurance exchange to try to make sure people are insured. And it's a very good thing to do, but it's a foundation upon which to build true and meaningful health care reform. And I am committed to taking those additional steps to make sure that our health care system is appropriately used by individuals seeking care and that the care that they receive is appropriate to their needs. Getting the right care at the right time at the right place will help bend that cost curve. We're going to, you know, this is just foundational work in terms of the nuts and bolts of how the exchange will function to buy the products, to get people inserted into the product that best meets their needs, the insurance product. The one piece in here that could really help work with that is actually the active purchaser component, where the exchange itself can try to drive value out of the market by making sure that the products available are putting the right incentives in for products that incentivize getting the right type of care. Something like that could be a piece of it, but it's not a very direct tool. We have a lot more work to do to get to the healthcare reform to meet the triple aims of better personal experiences in their interactions with the healthcare system, better population-based health, and then through doing those two well, bending the cost curve. And those are all additional pieces to be addressed in future legislation. This is the nuts and bolts of how the exchange itself operates to help people find the right insurance product for them.
Thank you, and follow up, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Senator. I'll just comment and then ask a question directly on the fiscal aspect. So basically what what you just said is that what you're doing, the work you're doing here today, is not really dealing with the cost of health care in Minnesota. It is just dealing with insurance. So my next question would be on page one, the fiscal note, right at the bottom right, 104 FTEs. Can you tell me where these people are going to be? Maybe it's in here someplace. Can you point to the page in here where it's going to tell me where these people are going to be housed, when they're going to go online? I think that actually might be self-explanatory in here. But 104 new state employees, where they're going to be housed, and how many of those 104 employees in this fiscal note? Because I know you do have local impact here. It is checked as local impact. What is it going to cost the counties? Are the counties included in this 104 new employees to help run this insurance?
Mr. Chair, Senator Ingebrigtsen, the list of employees is largely on pages 10 and 11 of 47. The county relationships are largely the functions that the counties serve right now with the Medicaid population would continue to be served. There isn't an estimate that they would increase or decrease that. And it is significant work that they do today. The navigator / in-person assister program, counties would be eligible if they choose to function in that role. They could apply to get grants for providing that additional level of service beyond what they do today, but that's a county option. There's no requirement that they do so. And that's it.
Senator Nino.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Couple of things. One, this to contradict a little bit what Senator Lurie said, far be it from
what?
Me, Senator Lurie. This bill absolutely is significant health insurance reform, but it is also health care reform. I don't want to belabor the point, but it's in the bill. Page 3, line 22, it's for care management. If that's not health care, what is it, auto care? And reading between the lines, there's a lot more there, and it's more than just that. But this bill does touch on that. I expressed those concerns in the health committee when expressing some concerns about where this board might go, but that's not specifically finance related. I did want to go back to the breakdown, the numbers that you gave us on the uninsured. That was actually helpful, and I had a follow-up question on the 43%, those that are mandated but are opting out. With these specific percentages, I'm assuming that we have some more detail on what makes up that demographic. Who makes up those 43%? Could I get a little more information on that? I'm assuming you don't have it, but maybe the department does. Or.
Mr. Chair, Senator Nienau, I can ask the department for additional details on that. I don't know if they'll be able to get them to us during the committee. They will if they can. Otherwise, we can follow up.
If they don't have anything, could they come up and just say, sorry, I can't answer, but I'd like to know what I can.
Mr. Chair, Senator Nienau, April Todd Mumlop with the Exchange. The numbers that that Senator Lurie just referenced are from Dr. Gruber's report. We don't have any more detailed information than that in the report, but we could follow up with him to see if there's more detail we could get from the model. But we don't have that information today.
Okay. Mr. Chair, that's fine. If there is more detail, I would appreciate seeing it if it's available. My hunch is that what we're looking at there mostly is going to be young, healthy individuals. What is if those individuals opt out, there's a penalty. What is the penalty for them, or the tax, I guess?
Mr. Chair, Senator Nienau, the tax increases over time. So it starts off initially at greater of $95 or 1% of someone's income, and goes up over a few years to up to 2.5% of a person's income.
And Mr. Chair, where I'm going with this is my hunch is, and maybe I'm wrong, but my hunch is that there's going to be a lot of really healthy young individuals that are going to look at paying I'm making up a number here, a couple $3,000 a year for health insurance or paying a $95 penalty, and knowing that they can sign up anytime they want, are probably going to opt for the $95 penalty. And if the estimates on this are wrong, if there's a much lower uptake, I guess would be the proper term for that, of this young, healthy demographic who only has to pay $100 or maybe $200 or whatever, the cost-benefit analysis in their mind, now it might be the wrong decision, but I remember being 21 and 22 and being invincible, and that's going to increase the cost for everybody else. That's the idea behind the mandated coverage. Everybody's in the pool because the young, healthy individuals are paying the same as the older individuals. And, in fact, the same consultant that gave you these numbers indicated that typically the young, healthy premiums are going to increase significantly, maybe 25%. It's from the same consultants. And so the young, healthy people aren't going to be paying the same premium as the older, unhealthier people. They're actually going to be paying higher premiums compared to what they would be paying in the current market. And so I have concerns there. Senator Lori, that's no fault of yours in drafting this legislation. That's just a result of the law that you're trying to comply with. So I make that point simply because it is absolutely a financial point, and I think I'm going to be proven more right than wrong, but only time will tell. But I just want to put that on the record so that if nothing else, at least in 5 years, I can say I told you so, Mr. Chair.
Well, I'm forced to ask. Senator Miller has a question, and I want to get to, Senator Miller, your concern about the fiscal note. But so your concern is that the younger, healthier individuals who are now forced to be part of an insurance pool will be paying more, and as a consequence, it's going to do what to the rest of the population?
Mr. Chair, my concern isn't necessarily that they will opt one way or the other. My concern is that the assumptions on the uptake of that younger population, I think, are overly optimistic, and particularly because of the dynamics involved in the demographic breakdowns and the way that these insurance rates are going to be affected, according to Gruber-Gorman. Generally, the younger, healthier populations are going to see significant premium increases compared to what they'd be paying today. And when you're looking at paying thousands of dollars for your health insurance or paying a $100 fine, and you're a 23-year-old college student who's not eligible because your parents aren't on a group plan, a lot of them are going to opt for the $95 penalty, knowing that they can sign up anytime they want.
But at least we'll get the $95 from them as opposed to zero.
Mr. Chair, my concern is about the assumptions, not about the younger individuals.
All right. Senator Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And actually, Senator Nino just asked the question that I had about the tax penalty, but so how does that work for family? Is it $95 per individual? So if it's a family of four, is it just the two adults that get taxed the $95, or are children under 18 excluded, or what is that? And then where does the money go? What fund does those penalty dollars go to?
Mr. Chair, Senator Miller, so under the law, there's an either or that's established. So it's the greater of $95 or 1% of a person's income. So that would be applied to the family unit. And on the upper end, I think it's $695 or 2.5% of someone's income, and that's in 2016. So it goes up each consecutive year, 14, 15, 16 will increase. And it is a tax penalty, so it is assessed through the tax filing system through the IRS.
And it goes to?
It goes to the federal government.
Yeah. Okay. Similar. Mr. Chair, just a follow-up. Did I hear you say $695 or $95?
Mr. Chair, Senator Miller, it phases up over time. So it starts at $95 in 2014. It's the greater of $95 or 1% of income. And by 2016, it is increased to $695 or 2.5% of income, whichever is greater.
So, Mr. Chair, so there for those who decide not to comply with the mandate, each individual, the penalty in 2016 will be $695 or 2.5% of their income, whichever is greater. So that might get to the point where $95, I see, you know, maybe there's an advantage not to get on, but $695, that's a pretty significant tax penalty for those individuals. How is it going to be enforced for the 21 or 23-year-old college student? It's all enforced through the federal government, is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator Miller, that's correct.
Okay, Mr. Chair.
You know, just a observation, we're talking largely here about the federal law rather than Senate File 1, but a couple of important aspects of this, you know, children up to age 26 are able to be covered on their insurance policy. So many, many, many of these 21, 22, 23-year-olds are going to be able to be covered by their parents' policies. I know darn well I'm keeping my kids on through this entire period. Certainly not all parents have a group policy that would be applicable to. But as this percent of income grows, it's the larger of the assessment or the percentage of income, and that's designed so that by the time you get above the 400% of federal poverty level into the higher incomes, it's actually a really significant penalty, and that's, you know, intended by the feds to drive take up of these policies. So if you're at the lower end of the income scale and you're at $95, the federal tax advanced premium tax credits and cost sharing reductions are going to be phenomenally beneficial to you, and that $95 is going to look like something real compared to what you're going to be able to get on the exchange. And it's designed to have those two functions working together. And so there will be some of that. The Gruber-Gorman, you know, I mean, you said you have a hunch. Well, we hired the best health economists in the nation to try to put some bounds on that. They said 86,000 is the number. And that's what I'm going to go with instead of your hunch, Senator Ninau. I'm sorry.
Okay. Why don't we, Senator Newman, you had a quick question?
Yeah, very quick, Mr. Chairman, if I may.
Sure.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to follow up on Senator Ingebretson's questions regarding the FTE, Senator Lori. And when I'm looking at the fiscal note, it looks like in 2015 we got 55 FTEs. 2016, we go up to 102. 2017, we go up to 104. In addition to those full-time employees, Senator Lori, is there built into this exchange or this health insurance exchange the ability of those full-time employees to go outside of the exchange for purposes of hiring independent contractors to perform services? Is there an ability to put forth grants to hire independent contractors for the purposes of performing services? In other words, are there others in addition to the 104 full-time employees going to be hired to help with this exchange? Excuse me. And if so, how much is that going to cost?
Senator,
Mr. Chair, Senator Newman, the full costs are described here in the fiscal note. So there isn't additional contracting beyond what's described in the fiscal note. A quick explanation of why fiscal 14 is zero FTEs and fiscal 15 is you know, half of the FTEs of 16. That's because in fiscal year 14, it's entirely federally financed, and in half of fiscal year 15, it's still federally financed. And so we're talking about the FTEs that are paid for by the state, and so fiscal year 15 is only half 6 months of the state bearing the cost for the employees that are functioning here, but this is the entirety of the employees.
Mr. Chair, if I may, I'm sorry, Senator, I don't think you answered my question.
Oh.
I'm not looking for information regarding the full-time employees. I'm asking whether or not within this insurance exchange, there are going to be others hired as independent contractors over and above the 104 full-time employees that will be paid out of this exchange. Independent contractors through grants to the local units of government, something other than the 104 full-time employees.
Mr. Chair, Senator Newman, there will be the 104 FTEs. There will be the grants for navigators and in-person assisters that we've already covered and that are included in these costs, and that's it.
No nonprofits?
Well, nonprofits are, you know, likely to be navigators and brokers, some of them. I'm not brokers, I'm sorry. Navigators and in-person assisters. I need to keep that straight, too. Senator Anderson is shaking his head. So nonprofits could get a contractual relationship to provide that navigator's in-person assister function, as could counties. And that's, you know, those costs are reflected in the fiscal note.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, let's have a few minutes. We've got several amendments, but Sarah Miller had requested, I agreed, to have a couple minutes with maybe Mr. Albrecht, Ms. Julek, to talk about the fiscal. Mr. Albrecht's volunteering, Ms. Julek. That's because Ms. Julek really misses being with us as much as is that correct, Ms. Julek? You don't have
Mr.
to
Mr. Chair, I always miss being here.
Maybe I should just indicate for people who don't know, Ms. Julek was a highly competent fiscal analyst for the Health and Human Services Division of the Senate for quite a while, and then she was forced to leave to go to the department, I think.
To be a mom.
And that too. Ms. Julek.
Mr. Chair, members, I think the easiest way might be if we refer to the summary tables, which include the cost categories, and then backtrack within the fiscal note for the details of each of those lines. So again, on page 17, the three summary tables for the high, medium, and low enrollment scenarios are listed there. With the cost categories. The first cost category is personnel. We've referred to this a little bit. All positions are listed within the fiscal note starting on page 10. This includes the management staff, support positions, business positions, and IT positions listed in the subsequent tables going through page 11 and summarized on page 12. In addition to these positions, there is language in the bill requiring a salary for the board members that is listed on the top of page 12 in that summary table. So you'd have all the positions summarized in this table 9 on top of page 12, including the board salary and then the calculation of the fringe. In addition to that, there'd be a number of administrative support costs. Those are listed in the next table 10. These are your general administrative supplies, communication costs, computer replacement, rent, printers, things like that. And I will just note that all of the positions and all of these support costs reflect what's been submitted in federal grants for the setup of the exchange and are simply carried forward into this fiscal note for starting in calendar 15. So these costs have all been reflected in federal grants and are being carried forward in the fiscal note. The next item on the summary table are contractual costs. We would estimate a number of contracts. Those are listed on page 13. We would assume that there would be a contract for the quality rating system. This would be analysis to help us implement the quality rating systems for the products. We would have some kind of annual training assistance. The current grants include funding for the initial training and the initial curriculum development. This would be an ongoing, maintaining that training structure. We'd potentially have Attorney General contracts. We'd have marketing and outreach contracts to assist with the promotion and social media promotion advertisement to outreach to members, and then printing of communication materials. And so those would be the estimated contractual costs that would be part of the exchange. Under IT infrastructure costs, there's two basic categories for that. That's found on page 13 on table 11. Within the current federal grants, we are purchasing a number of hardware and software and equipment to set up the infrastructure. We will need to have annual license and maintenance agreements for all these purchases. So what's reflected in the infrastructure line is that annual cost to maintain those license agreements, maintain those maintenance and update agreements, and that's, depending if it's hardware or software, it's either 25% or 30% of the original cost, which is the standard for licensing agreements. The second piece is on the marketing place tool. This is the contract we have to stand up the website portal and the eligibility determination and the product comparison tools. We know there will be annual license agreements for those items that we are procuring, and that is estimated at $3.3 million. So between the two, $10.3 million is assumed for that ongoing IT infrastructure maintenance cost. The next line is a customer service area. There are three basic areas for customer service. There's the in-person assisters and navigators. There's a call center and notification line. So that would be another area where there could be additional contracting for persons, if you will. And then appeals, I'm sorry, there's four sections, appeals, processing, and then premium billing and collection. What this fiscal note assumes is a per member per month cost for each of those activities based on a Wakely budget model that the exchange is using. The Wakely Consulting Group is a group that worked out of the Massachusetts Exchange. Based on that experience, has developed per member per month cost for some of these customer service activities. Based on that model, we are projecting the cost shown on page 14 for high, medium, and low enrollment scenarios. The enrollment scenarios are, well, it gets very convoluted. Enrollment scenarios are based on initially Dr. Gruber's 2016 projected enrollment, and then back down in 14 and 15 to assume a phase up. Those assumptions are found on page 7. In table 2. So as an example, the enrollment projection for tax credits was 370,000 people. Based on the model for 2014, 15, and 16, a low, medium, and high enrollment phase-up for that number was assumed. So in 2014, if the low enrollment scenario is assumed, that 40% box would be applied to the 370,000. If the medium enrollment would be 50% and high enrollment was 60%. So each year had a phase-in assumption against that 2016 endpoint estimate by the Gruber-Gorman analysis. Those annual enrollment amounts are then calculated into monthly enrollment for the year, and Table 3 reflects how we assume within that calendar year that participation phases into the exchange. They're not all showing up day one. They're going to show up over a period of time during the year. And so in 2014, we assume they're coming in with the first 3 months. Open enrollment in the first year goes through March of 2014. And then there's more of a churn in the subsequent months. In 2015, we'd assume the new growth would be seen pretty upfront in January because open enrollment would end in December of that year. Based on that, a member month calculation is calculated and shown in Table 4, and those member months then are used against that per member per month cost from the Wakely budget model that is shown for the various customer service activities. Again, that includes the in-person assisters and navigators, the customer service, which is call center notices and other communications, the appeals process, and the premium billing. So based on that calculation as it rolls out to Table 14, 15, and 16, those numbers carry forward to the summary table. The remaining of the cost deal with other agencies. Department of Health and Department of Commerce each have a fiscal note in here for staff regarding the regulatory activity on the plan certification. It is assumed that those costs would be part of the cost that would be certified for the health impact fee transfer. So they are reflected here as well, but I can't speak to the specifics of those costs that are detailed in their fiscal notes. It also includes a $250,000 transfer in fiscal 14 for the training of the Navigator in-person assister program that would be transferred to the Department of Human Services. The fiscal note also assumes a statewide indirect cost assumption, which I think is fairly standard. And then in 14 and 15, there are Medicaid costs allocated associated with the grant. That's reflected here because it's also showing up in the DHS fiscal note because there's a state share of that cost that needs to be captured in the fiscal note. So you'd have a total expenditures within each of these scenarios, and again, focusing on the high enrollment scenario. The fiscal 14 is reflected of the DHS cost, including the navigator training and the Medicaid cost. Fiscal 15 represents a half a year of operations. The other half is covered with federal grants. And then fiscal 16 and 17 reflect the full operations at $57.7 million in 16 and $61 million in 17. Of that, the revenues would be assumed to be broken down. The Medicaid allocation be about $9 to $10 million in any given year scenario. And this is based on estimated participation ratios of Medicaid against the entire participation and applied against everything except the customer service numbers. It is assumed that the Medicaid program has its current eligibility customer service through the county that the exchange would not pay for. It has other call centers or other consumer assistance services, appeals processes that would continue to run as they currently exist and not run through the exchange. Therefore, none of the customer service amounts have been allocated to the Medicaid program. The balance of the costs would have been allocated to Medicaid. And that's why, even though the Medicaid participation is roughly over 50%, it's only applied against the against the line items that that Medicaid would directly benefit, and the customer service would have its separate Medicaid activity. After you take out the Medicaid allocation, the balance would need to be accounted for with the health impact fee transfer, which in the high scenario is estimated in fiscal 16 at $48.2 million and in 17 at $52 million.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Look. And I don't know if people have questions in the fiscal note. I do need to take a minute, though, to apologize to members of the committee. When I was in the House, my second, third terms, I served on appropriations. When I came to the Senate, there wasn't room for me on the way we had the Finance Committee structured. So I was on the Tax Committee for a term, then came to Finance. And I really didn't do a very good job of adopting the cleverness of the Tax Committee because I only served on it for a term. And so I apologize for that I just didn't adopt kind of the coloration of Tax Committee membership because of my limited stay on the committee. But it should be noted that what the Tax Committee did was to take the health impact fee, the general fund health impact fee, to substitute for the premium payment to pay for this. And I don't have an amendment relative to that, and we might be a little bit too far along to deal with that. But just so members understand, because of my lack of cleverness, we have a hole in the budget for this committee. And when we set targets for the individual divisions, and it's not it particularly relates to the chairs of the divisions, we'll have to figure out how to account for that. And I'll have to go around the table, and Senator Dibble doesn't have a lot of general fund money, and Senator Latz has a fairly small budget. Senator Wicker's got a lot of money, and Senator Lori's got a lot of money, and Senator Bonoff's got a lot of money, and Senator Tomasoni has a mixture of money, and so we'll have to figure out who's going to pay for the cleverness of the Tax Committee. Any questions for Ms. Julek relative to the Senator Miller?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As a new member, I have to say I don't have any idea what the heck you're talking about.
As you know, time doesn't really help that, Chair.
But I do know what you're talking about as far as this committee having to fill a general fund hole of $60 million.
Sir Miller, let me just defend myself that over the years I've been here, I'm always amazed at the cleverness of the Tax Committee. They're really clever. And it doesn't really matter who the chairman is or who the membership is. They're really, really, really clever. Not as clever as me. So that's my apology.
No problem. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have a question for the testifier. I noticed that in all three scenarios, there's a high enrollment scenario, a medium enrollment scenario, and a low enrollment scenario, but yet the FTEs, the full-time equivalents, are the same in all three Can you please explain, I mean, if there's less, if there's a lower enrollment, why do we have the same FTEs in this department?
Mr. Chair, Senator, the FTEs are really more about the relationship with the stakeholder partners, so with the navigator brokers, with the a direct relationship to the call center but not operating the call center. So I think the fluctuation of cost is really more in that customer service line, so at the call center, how that's where it grows and shrinks, or within the in-person assisters is where the funding grows and shrinks. But you'd always need some kind of base program support and development within the central office to be that liaison, if you will, with that program. But the size of that connection to the participant would be reflected in the customer service line.
Okay, thank you. And Mr. Chair, one more question. To your point, there was a pretty significant change made in the Senate Tax Committee as far as funding, and I'd just like to get some input from Senator Lurie, if he's more receptive of the up to 3.5% withhold or the health impact fee, and if we do use the health impact fee, that does have a impact on the general fund, and how are we going to handle that impact on the general fund?
Well, Senator Lurie's kind of caught in the middle on some of this, but if he wants to answer, he can.
Mr.
Chair,
if
he doesn't his position.
Or if he doesn't want to answer.
Mr. Chair, Senator Miller, I'm not a member of the Tax Committee, so I was before them, and I characterized myself as neutral on the matter. I mean, the Tax Committee has a big job to do. They chose to use this financing mechanism, and I told them I would work to uphold the Senate's position on it. That said, I had grown quite attached to the little withhold that we had carried this bill with for some time. But at the end of the day, the really important features of the financing mechanism are that it really provide a stable, self-sustaining, and sufficient revenue stream, and either funding mechanism does meet those core requirements. I think there's some, there's pretty good arguments on either side of this. And
so, Senator Miller, let me make it clear, my apology notwithstanding, this committee does not have jurisdiction to raise taxes, but the Tax Committee doesn't have jurisdiction to use general fund money within the jurisdiction of the Finance Committee. But again, we're pretty far down the road. Senator Bonoff.
Mr. Chair, Senator Lurie, I do have questions on the fiscal note, but I just want to say broadly that I appreciate what you have done in bringing the bill to this point, that it is an enormous undertaking that you have tackled and your staff and your team have tackled. So I know there have been points within the bill that you and I don't agree on, but I don't want to lose sight of how much I appreciate the work that you're doing, because I think, first and foremost, we have identified that an exchange is a good thing. And that view was, shared by many. For example, some of the points Senator Westrom was making with regard to their criteria that were set in the changes that you made to the bill, I really appreciated and would like to see that even stronger, so that the criteria in itself became, what decides who's in and who's out. But again, that's not under the purview of the Finance Committee. With regard to the Finance Committee, my concerns is really just the overall cost. I'm just concerned about, I did not expect as we tackled this that it would actually cost this much. And so I've just been paging through it, trying to understand what really drives the numbers. And again, to the Senator Miller's questions, it seems that the fact that these numbers don't vary depending on low, medium, or high, and I understand your statement, but yet then if you look at where most, a lot of the funding is in pretty senior-level management. I mean, a third of these people are making, $90,000 or $100,000 a year. So these are kind of executive-type folks, I would think. And so to have that many people not change whether or not you've got high take-up, middle take-up, or high or low, medium, high, you got my point, doesn't seem to make common sense to me. And so I worry that we're taking this money out of the general fund, which is preciously scarce, and putting it in this structure and building up infrastructure based on assumptions which may or may not play out. And so I guess one question is, where did we get these assumptions, and do they compare to what other states have found?
Senator Lurie.
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonoff, let me start with reiterating a point that I made early on, and that is, you know, I think it's important to compare how we're going to do with what the alternative is. The federal exchange in 2016 will still be funded by a 3.5% withhold on insurance products sold through the exchange. In the fiscal estimates, they were drafted with the withhold in there, so they were based on a percentage of the withhold. Now they're just a number, but it's the same number. And it's down to 2% of premiums sold on the exchange. So, I mean, you know, at some level, you have to say, you know, we're being significant, and that's based on a medium enrollment scenario is the one I always go to. I try not to be wildly optimistic or overly pessimistic. So with the medium enrollment scenario, by the end of 2016, the estimates were that we'd be down at 2% of premiums to operate our exchange. And again, you have to kind of compare that to the Fed's have made it clear. They're going to be at 3.5% through this entire period.
But, Mr. Chair, on that point, Senator Lurie, but if we were using the withhold, then we would be taking that percentage based on the number of people who actually did participate. And the way this cost structure is, we've put those assumptions in stone, and we've taken that amount and staffed to that level.
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonoff, we've projected what the costs would be, and we did that under the projections as a percentage when it was a percentage. We've done it as you know, as just a number in this, but it's still just a projection. What it would be is a certification of costs to MMB and a transfer of those costs. And so, to the extent that they can get more efficient, you know, we would be pushing very hard to make the exchange be more efficient, and it's possible we could get, you know, some FTEs out if the enrollment just really doesn't occur anywhere near what we're looking for. I don't, you know, I think that we did get really good, solid work done by Gruber and Gorman, and think that that's how we should look at what we're projecting. But again, these are just projections. We're going to be certifying costs and transferring those. I think that the incentive to be efficient is one of the things that we kind of do lose when we just go with the certification mechanism. When we had the withhold, you know, it created a direct incentive to drive efficiencies out of the system in order to get that withhold down to the lowest possible percent. But still, again, this mechanism does meet the sufficient self-sustaining requirements for an exchange.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Bonoff.
I understand that currently Massachusetts has an exchange. How do our projections compare to that?
So, Mr. Chair, Senator Bonoff, we do have a lot of comparisons to other states. And in terms of the staff, how we would describe the staffing is the 86 that are projected just for the exchange are broken out between IT staff and more business staff. And so the business staff is at 57. The IT staff is at 29. And so the breakout that's there, really that business staff is the staff to perform base-level functions that the exchange needs to perform. As Ms. Julik was highlighting, the variability in the budget that's based on enrollment is really around those variable costs around customer service. And so there are options in the bill for how you would do customer service ongoing, whether that would be FTEs or whether it would be through some type of contract. So there's some flexibility there. Those FTEs on customer service are not in here, but you do see under the customer service line some really, I think, striking variations in the customer service portions of the budget based on what the enrollment levels would be. If you compare things to Massachusetts has done things a little differently than we've done in Minnesota, particularly on the IT side. They don't have IT consolidation, and so they don't have the number of IT staff that we do. But on the business side, their business side staff is roughly around the same amount. In terms of the per member cost, we do have some comparisons to a few other states as well. Minnesota is actually the lowest or the second lowest state in terms of per member per month cost for the exchange.
Well, Mr. Chair, I meant enrollees. I didn't mean costs compared to other states.
Enrollees, Massachusetts, their enrollees are primarily on the individual market side. They don't have all that much enrollment on the small business side. It's mostly on the individual, and they have enrollees over a 200,000 mark, but they've structured their exchange a bit differently than what the federal requirements are.
Senator Tomasoni.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So, Mr. Chairman, due to the cleverness of the Tax Committee, when it came through my committee, this bill, I thought the 3.5% premium withhold was removed and that we're now using the health impact fee as financing, but I keep hearing people talk about the
Mr. The Chair, right. Senator Tomasoni, the withhold is how I read the fiscal note, and it's how I put it in my head. And so these calculations were a percentage of premiums. Now they're just a number, and so the number is the same, and it was changed into a matter of plugging that number into the spreadsheet. But it is the health impact fee. It is, we're going to certify costs to MMB. But in terms of comparing it to the feds is a withhold still. That's the mechanism they would use if we didn't do this and opted for the federal exchange. And so it's just a reference point when we talk about the withhold. It is not a withhold in this bill.
Okay. We have several people who've asked for a chance to testify, and we've got some possible amendments. We need to finish this bill today, so at some point we're going to have to give up the committee room. So if we don't finish, we'll come back at 6 o'clock tonight to finish the bill. So if we can get to people who've asked for the chance to testify, the first person is Kate Johansson. Ms. Johansson.
Mr. Chair and members, thank you. My name is Kate Johansson. I represent the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce and its 2,400 employers, 80% of which are eligible to participate in a state health insurance exchange. I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to testify on Senate File 1 this morning, and also again thank Senator Lurie for his work on this complicated and important legislation, as well as for his collaborative open-door policy in dealing with interested parties on this piece of legislation. The Minnesota Chamber of Commerce has long supported the legislative creation of a state health insurance exchange that empowers consumers to shop for products that meet their needs and resources. And while we do still have some concerns about this bill with respect to governance, the active purchaser power in the bill, the relationship to a potential second market rules bill and accountability, I'll tailor my comments today simply to the budgetary and financial implications of the legislation. Primarily with respect to the finance mechanism, and I apologize if this has already been discussed, I had to step out. The original mechanism in the bill was a 3.5% withhold, which some might characterize as a gross premium tax. The Chamber definitely opposed that mechanism because we think that it translates to a tax on small business, the implication of which is an increase on premiums. That concerns us because our 80% of small businesses already pay more than any other group for their premiums, and they regularly cite healthcare costs as one of the top three obstacles facing growth and their ability to retain employees. So anything that increases their premiums is certainly something that causes concern for us. We were pleased to see that the Senate Tax Committee removed that finance mechanism and implemented a different one using health impact fee, or effectively general fund money, which we think is a superior finance mechanism for a few reasons. First of all, it reflects the task force recommendations that there be a broad-based funding mechanism. And second, it provides for legislative accountability. The 3.5% withhold originally in the bill did not provide that. It would go into that withhold would have gone into a dedicated fund that would not have been subject to legislative appropriation, which we think would be appropriate for a program and agency of this size. So we would strongly urge you, as this bill moves forward, to retain the current finance mechanism in the bill. Second, certainly we have some concerns just with respect to the legislative process in accounting for the budget and taking a very strong, scrutinizing look at what we've proposed for this exchange. The state has already received over $100 million in federal grants and invested it in infrastructure, personnel, and a $41 million website. Having served on the finance work group of the state's advisory task force, I was a little concerned that we didn't have estimates on how much a state exchange would cost until last August, and also was concerned that the ranges estimated varied from $30 to $50 million, $40 to $60 million, and so on. Those are pretty substantial ranges when you're budgeting for a new state agency. Since then, obviously, we have a fiscal note that estimates the cost at over $60 million and also contemplates the addition of almost 100 new full-time employees. And the Chamber just wants to offer a few constructive suggestions in reviewing that particular fiscal note and its personnel implications. And first would be to try and establish a bill that meets minimum ACA requirements. The purpose being, A, that we're on a very short timeline, and that seems like a responsible approach to establishing a state exchange that forfends against a potential federal exchange being imposed on the state. So please keep this lean, keep the cost as low as possible, especially if those costs are going to be passed on to taxpayers. Second, look for opportunities to eliminate duplications. Particularly, I believe the exchange will perform marketing and auditing functions that may already be performed in other agencies. It might be appropriate to have the Office of the Legislative Auditor look into potential duplications and suggest areas where you could eliminate or streamline some costs to save additional money for taxpayers. And then third, calling back to the finance mechanism, we would certainly urge you to retain a finance mechanism that has the ultimate legislative oversight. I don't think it's appropriate to delegate complete oversight of a state agency's budget to that state agency without having the legislature regularly involved in maintaining oversight of that process. So with that, I'll try to keep my comments short, but I'm certainly available for questions or follow-up if anyone's interested. Thank you for your time.
Well, Mr. Hansen, I got a question. Since you like the use of the health impact fee, which is general fund dollars, and obviously not just for this biennium, but for bienniums into the future, so for this committee, would the chamber prefer then we take the money from K-12, higher ed, or health and human services to make up that difference? One of the three.
Mr. Chair and members, the chamber doesn't have an official position, but
of
we certainly
not.
Would be interested in having further discussions with you about where to find that money or what revenue sources would be appropriate.
Possibly increasing the governor's income tax. Would that be an appropriate place?
I don't think I'm the Mr. Chair and members. I'm not perhaps the appropriate person to answer that question, but I do think that there are taxes that might be more appropriately related to healthcare activities that we could have a discussion of, and certainly this committee would be the appropriate place to work on that, and I'm very happy to meet with anyone who's interested in discussing it.
Okay. Otherwise, it's kind of the square peg in the round hole school of financing. Thanks. For the questions, Ms. Serenino.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hansen, you talked about this being de facto general fund money, although it's technically not general fund money, and you referred to I forget the term you used, legislative oversight, but I don't see that in the bill. And what I see is that the board will certify their own costs, give that to whichever commissioner. The commissioner then takes that money out of the health impact fund first, gives it to the board, and then whatever's left over goes into the general fund, which, of course, the legislature has oversight over. But this money's gone before we see it. So I don't see legislative oversight in this, and I'm wondering where you do.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ninau, I guess I misunderstood that. When I was subject to the discussion in the Senate Tax Committee, my understanding was that the money would be appropriated subject to similar scrutiny as a general fund appropriation.
That's correct.
Okay, thank you. But I'm certainly willing to discuss the issue further with you and perhaps look at clarifying language if that's something of interest to the committee or other members.
Yes. Okay, thank you, Mr. Johansson. The next person who's asked to testify, and we have a written testimony in our packets, is, if he's here, is Todd Mickelson.
She's wrong and I'm right.
Okay, if not here, also we have written testimony from Mr. David Hoden. Okay, the last witness then. Oh, I'm sorry. I was looking at my wrong list. Twyla Brace, is she present? She had requested to testify. Well, this is going really well. I see Mr. Varco. He's going to kind of stop my chain of...
Chairman Cohen, members of the committee, my name is Rick Varco, and I'll try to be brief. I'm political director for SEIU Healthcare Minnesota. We represent 15,000 healthcare workers around the state. We support Senate File 1, especially the strong language to prevent board members with a conflict of interest and to give the board authority to select plans in the interest of consumers. We do, however, have serious concerns about the financing mechanism chosen by the Senate Tax Committee that you've been discussing. Let me start by saying we encourage you to reject calls for a bare-bones exchange that satisfies the minimum ACA requirements. I call your attention to a recent study by the Georgetown Health Policy Institute on the lessons learned from the Massachusetts and Utah exchanges. They noted that the Utah exchange performed poorly compared to Massachusetts because, quote, the lack of budget and staff made it difficult for the Utah exchange to respond and adjust to problems as they arose, unquote. This committee should maintain current staff and funding levels in the bill so that the exchange has the tools to succeed and provide value to consumers. This is especially true if the board will be an active purchaser. The same Georgetown report noted, quote, being an active purchaser requires staff expertise and resources, unquote. As for the funding mechanism, I testified before the Senate HHS Finance Committee about the need to add additional funding to the governor's budget for HHS programs like nursing homes that enjoy broad bipartisan support. I could hardly appear before you and not take issue with a proposal that takes money out of the general fund to fund this exchange. Unless you are prepared to make cuts in existing programs or raise taxes in order to make up for the loss of revenue, the legislature should restore the withhold. In addition, this committee knows the importance of maximizing our access to federal dollars. If the exchange is funded through the health impact fee, then 100% of the costs will be paid by Minnesota consumers and small businesses. If it is funded by a premium withhold, those premiums are subsidized by the federal government, and so a significant percentage of the cost will be picked up by the feds. This committee should also resist attempts to fund the exchange through the Healthcare Access Fund. Given recent good news about a real window of opportunity to preserve Minnesota care, we should preserve every dollar we need for that. SEIU supports the original premium withhold for four basic reasons. First, insurance carriers participating in the exchange should pay for it because they will realize significant financial benefits, including access to about $3.3 billion in new premium revenues and an estimated $2.1 billion in taxpayer subsidies. Second, insurers will save on existing administrative, marketing, and underwriting costs because the exchange will pick up many of those services for them or make them unnecessary. And I'll just note that the job of selling insurance just got a lot easier with federal subsidies and an individual mandate. Third, we should use the withhold mechanism because operations are financed directly by exchange enrollment. It can't be destabilized by external factors like changes in political leadership or shifting fiscal priorities. More importantly, in an economic downturn, funding will rise automatically. The withhold would increase as unemployed people or those whose employers dropped coverage enrolled in the exchange. For most HHS programs, just as a slowdown increases demand for, say, Medicare or Minnesota care, funding in the general fund decreases. If funded through a withhold, the exchange will not come to you in a downturn asking for more funding just to maintain existing services. Finally, the withhold mechanism ensures that out-of-state insurance carriers don't get a free ride on the Minnesota exchange. The ACA requires the exchange to allow at least two multi-state plans to offer products on our exchange. Any funding mechanism besides a direct assessment on carriers enables those out-of-state providers free access to the Minnesota health insurance market. Any Minnesota-specific fee or tax will leave them untouched. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Varco. The last witness is Ms. Commit.
Mr. Chair.
Oh, I'm sorry. Senator Fischbach? I'm sorry.
Are we going to even, Mr. Chair, discuss the changing back to a withhold here? I mean, I guess when you were talking about the tax committee being very clever, I got the impression that they outsmarted you, so to speak. And I guess I'm confused about the last testimony that are we going to discuss changing it over?
That's a determination for the committee. I'm going through the witnesses, and okay. Then we'll take action on the bill and amendments, whatever people want to do.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, my name is Catherine Kmit, and I represent the Minnesota Council of Health Plans. The council supports the creation of a state-based health insurance exchange that works for Minnesota. We have been working together with Senator Lurie, and we appreciate all of the hard work he and others have put into this important legislation. He has listened closely to our concerns, and we are very grateful that he has made some significant changes to the bill, which we support those changes. We do, however, have several key concerns with the language in the bill. And first is one of our major concerns is the language that gives the board the authority to decide which health plans can be offered through the exchange. And you've heard this referred to as the active purchaser model. Senator Lurie has made some improvements to the bill to clarify the selection process of which health carriers will be allowed to offer health plans in the exchange beginning in 2015, and we greatly appreciate that level of transparency. But the process is still unclear for the first year of participation in the exchange for 2014, and we think it's critically important to the success of the exchange that first year of operations works well for consumers. Giving the board the authority to choose which carriers participate in the exchange allows the board then to pick winners and losers in the private marketplace, which could have negative long-term consequences for consumers. We support allowing any carrier that meets the state and federal requirements to participate in the exchange if they so choose. I also want to thank Senator Lurie and the Tax Committee for changing the funding source from the 3.5% premium tax on individuals and small businesses to the health impact fee. And because of some of the earlier testimony and some of the questions, I'm going to ask the page if they would be so kind as to pass out some documents that just to help the committee understand this very important issue. What I'm going to distribute to you are two things. One is a pie chart that shows where Minnesotans get their health insurance. This is the entire state population of about 5.3 million people, and these are the latest numbers from 2010. And those of you who don't serve on the Health and Human Services Committee or the Commerce Committee may not be aware most people get their health insurance through their employer, but only the people in this red part of the pie chart get it through an individual policy or a small group or large group policy that is regulated by the state of Minnesota, so regulated by all of you. The employees in the green part are purchased coverage through a self-funded plan. Those are large employers that have enough resources to self-fund their own claims. They might hire a health plan to administer the claims, but they pay for it themselves. And the advantage there is that they are exempt from all of the state requirements, mandates, state taxes, et cetera. And it makes their spend on the claims a little bit less expensive. In fact, quite a bit less expensive, as evidenced by this tax chart that is being distributed to you. Just to give you an idea, for individuals and small groups that purchase in the fully insured market, they already pay a much higher tax burden as a part of their overall premium. The lines up above that are that have white lines in them, those are the proposed federal taxes that are coming, as well as the 3.5% premium tax, which is not in Senator Lurie's bill, but we are talking about it and talking about perhaps putting that back in. What I want to demonstrate to you is that that tax falls not on a broad-based population. The column over here, this little column, is what the self-funded people in the state pay. They pay up through the provider tax because it's not really taxed at the individual enrollee level. It's a tax that is collected at the provider level. This is important for you to know so that you understand the why we oppose the premium tax. It's not as fair as a broader-based tax, and I think one of the good things about what happened in the tax committee was that it changed the discussion a little bit to bring it back to the legislature to have that discussion about what is the appropriate way to fund this mechanism. We, from a public policy standpoint, we believe the health impact fee is a much more stable funding mechanism, especially in the first few years of the operations of the exchange. And it's more stable because it's a broad-based fee from the general fund and not just on a subset of the fully insured market. It captures a much larger section of the overall population. The original funding source, the 3.5% premium tax, depends on meeting aggressive enrollment targets. So the more people that participate in the exchange, the more tax that will be collected from them. However, failure to meet those targets could put the exchange in jeopardy. A more stable funding source will give the exchange some ability to build their resources and make sure the areas of their budgets are adequately funded. For example, if enrollment estimates begin to fall short, it may be necessary to invest more in the Navigator program and less in other areas in order to accelerate outreach to historically uninsured populations. As policymakers, you have an opportunity to thoroughly review this legislation to ensure consumers have an exchange that meets the minimum requirements. And may I just add, the minimum requirements of the federal law does not mean it's a bare-bones kind of exchange, or that the products in the exchange will somehow be not as good as what you can currently buy today. In fact, the products that are going to be sold through the exchange must meet another level of federal requirements in order to be sold through the exchange. And it frankly is a very high bar. So enrollees will be assured to get good quality products. The fiscal note for the exchange is very large and deserves careful examination. We urge you to avoid making the exchange overly prescriptive, with limited consumer choice, and so expensive that it fails to meet the needs of the consumers. We don't want to end up with more people uninsured. In conclusion, we want the exchange to work in Minnesota, but as currently drafted, we cannot support the bill. Nevertheless, we remain committed to working with Senator Lori on these concerns and other provisions that have been modified so we can create an exchange that works for Minnesota. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you for your time. Senator Goodwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Kmet, this chart you handed out is one that was handed out in one of the other six meetings that I've heard this bill in. And I just want to say that, just want to let people know that even if we accept the federal plan, we're going to have exactly the same percentage of taxes. Nothing is going to change except that maybe we can get our premium fee down to under 3.5. We know we can't do that with the feds, but otherwise none of this is going to change if we let the federal government control this, which is the law of the land right now. So we can't make it not happen. One way or the other, it's going to happen.
Well, and Madam Chair, or Mr. Chairman and Senator Goodwin, we agree with you. We don't want to have a federal exchange for a number of reasons, including that financing mechanism. However, Minnesota has an opportunity to find alternative financing mechanisms, not just the premium tax. It could be a variety of things to make it more broad-based and fair.
Okay. Thank you. Further discussion, amendments?
Mr. Chair?
On the product, I'm sorry.
I've got a...
Senator Lori?
I've got an amendment, a rather technical clarifying amendment I would like to adopt.
Sure. What number is that?
I believe it's the A100 at this point, and it needs an oral amendment, too. I had a note sent up to me.
If we could have that amendment distributed.
And just so that people can understand the oral amendment, I'm going to eliminate that Section 19 appropriations section, which was just confusing, and maybe I'll start to describe the bill. And again, it's a clarifying and technical amendment, really. Lines 1.3 through 1.9 really clarify.
To it, Sir Lori.
We don't have it yet.
We haven't distributed it.
This is being passed out. Just a real quick question directed to you. Do you know how much money is in the health care impact fund right now?
Not sure. Mr. Nauman?
Mr. Chair and members, it's about $200 million.
Say it again.
Isn't it zero? I mean, it generates about $200 million.
Sure. Mr. Chair and Senator Lurie, of course, that's an important distinction because all of it gets deposited into the general fund under current law, which is why there's a we're showing a general fund cost associated with everything that you've been discussing today, but that's the balance prior to the distribution.
What is the question?
About the fact that it's really the cigarette tax.
Right. And I'm sorry, maybe really quickly, Mr. Nauman can help me with this. What would be the percentages of the insurance you're talking about, the 2.5%, what would that generate?
Mr. Nauman.
Mr. Chair and members, I think I'd let some of the folks that are more conversant with some of the bill in front of you answer that question. I'm not as conversant on the health. The 2.5% premium.
Ms. Julek.
Thank you.
Would generate.
Mr. Chair, member, if it was the question, how much would the withhold generate each year? The way the fiscal note was put together, it was to generate enough to meet that year's cost. And so, for example, in fiscal 16, under the medium scenario, the 2% would have generated the $40 million reflected in that's now a HIF transfer. Under the high enrollment scenario, it was a 1.75% withhold to generate the $48 million reflected here.
Okay. Thank you. All right, we have the 800 amendment. Senator Lori, you want to explain the amendment?
Yeah, lines 1.3 to 1.9 rather really clarify that the requirements and standards for navigators apply to the in-person assister program as well. That's really just a clarification. Lines 1, 10, and 11 are technical. Lines 12 through 15 are to address the fact that whichever is later was left in the bill and put in the wrong place in regarding the MCHA language, so that's really a technical piece too. And then I would like to orally amend the A100 to delete lines 116 through 122. That actually is going to be done anyway. That transfer is going to be done, but the manner in which this was described makes it more confusing rather than less confusing. We were trying to clarify, and this didn't quite get us there.
Senator Lawyer, you're excluding 116 to 120. Is that correct?
Yes, 120. I'm sorry.
Okay. And then also on line 1.6, in honor of my predecessor, Senator Miriam, do you want to change established to establishing?
Absolutely. I would like to do that.
Okay. So we have Senator DeBolt.
I think we will delete 1.15 as well.
That's correct. Mm-hmm. Senator Lawyer, are you going to incorporate you'll incorporate all that.
I'll incorporate all of those oral amendments.
All right. We have Senator Lori's 100 amendment in front of us. Is there further discussion? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Further amendments on the part of the committee?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Fishbach.
Mr. Chair, I have the A96 amendment.
Okay, if we can have that distributed. Senator Fishbach?
Mr. Chair, the A96, actually, it is a Senator Benson had asked me to offer it on behalf, and she has had discussions with Senator Lori and Senator Pappas regarding it, and both of them are okay with it. But what it does is it takes the salary after the initial period. December 31, 2015, and there's a high compensation that is being offered during that period, and then it
brings it down to after that $55 per diem and travel. Here's what Senator Benson said. She recognizes the fact that the first couple of years is going to be very busy, that compensation would be well deserved during that first period, but after that, when it levels off a little bit. So then it would go down to the $55 per diem and the travel expenses. My understanding is that she has aligned that with the Public Utilities Commission.
And no. Correct me if I'm wrong. Senator Lori is familiar with the public.
Senator Lori.
Mr. Chair, Senator Fischbach, I am familiar with this amendment. I have talked with Senator Benson as well, and I would consider this a friendly amendment. I would think that it would not necessarily push our hand, but we could review it and determine whether, you know, this was added in state and local, our very first stop, the idea of compensating the boards to try to attract more expertise. And we can revisit it and determine whether it's the right level or not. But we'll just put in statute that it sunsets the compensation after 2 years. And I would consider that a friendly amendment.
Mr. Chair.
So we have Senator Fischbach's motion on the A96 amendment. Is there further discussion? Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This was my original provision. And I do feel like there is going to be a lot of work for this board during the first year, possibly even the second year. But then, as Senator Fischbach mentioned, it could ease off. So I think we can add this amendment, and then we can always look at it next year to see if the board members think it's going to be an ongoing heavy workload for them, or if it's going to be more a staff workload, and they'll just be providing more oversight. So I support the amendment.
All right. Anybody else who wants to support? Senator Edwardson, do you support?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a point of clarity, what are they going to be paid coming right out of the program? And then what is this, you know, the dollar figures at 55, I think, Senator Fischbach?
Mr. Chairman, go ahead. I can answer that question. It's their compensation is initially $30,000 a year, and that is comparable to the Metropolitan Sports Commission, what they make. And that would be, you know, the assumption that they're going to be meeting – they're going to be meeting weekly. There's going to be subcommittees that are involved. That why we did that is we wanted to be sure we had a wide enough group of people who could participate, so that if people were taking off time from work, or a small business owner was taking time from running their small business, or an academic was taking time from their teaching and research load, or a retired healthcare executive was, you know, flying up from wherever to spend time on this commission, flying back and forth from Arizona or Florida to do this, we would be able to have a wide enough pool of people who would be willing to take on this responsibility. And we want it to be a working board. We want them to take it very seriously and not just to have it be staff driven. So after the 2-year period, or it could be sooner even, but probably likely 2-year period, it would drop to what the standard per diem rate is, which I believe is $55 a day.
Okay.
Yes.
All right. We have the A96 amendment from us, moved by Senator Fischbach. If there's no further discussion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion carries. Further discussion or amendments on the bill? Senator Lino.
Well, Mr. Chair, I have a number of different questions. And I guess I do want to go back to, we had a brief discussion on this a little bit. You alluded to it, Mr. Chair, about the fact that the tax committee gave us a pretty significant hole in our general fund by using what amounts to general fund money. Ultimately, this money ends up there, although it filters through the special fund first. And this is no small amount. In the first biennium, I think it's about $36,000, but you get into the out years, it's fully implemented. According to the fiscal note, we're talking $118 million. I sat in on another committee when a question was asked to Senator Lori, and his response, I wasn't on the committee, but I was observing, and his response was, well, that's the tax committee's problem. They created it. Mr. Chairman, I think it's this committee's problem. They created it, but it's our problem. And the question then is begged, what are we going to do?
Well, Senator, you know, you're a member of the committee. If the committee wants to do something, the committee can do something. There's no question that – and I want to be a little bit careful. The hole certainly in this biennium is there. It's not – you know, it's $20 million. So it's – in the overall scheme of things, it's not hundreds of millions of dollars. Obviously, as you point out, it ramps up in subsequent bienniums and creates a further hole. So, but it's up to the committee as to what the committee would like to do.
Mr. Chair, is your intent to vote on this and move this out or hold this over so that we can take a look at some more things? What are we going to do today?
I mean, the difficulty we have is an imposed deadline, and Senator Lurie, I think the requirement is, what, March 31st? Is that correct? Am I?
Yes.
So the difficulty we have, and that's not our deadline. I mean, that's the Federal Health and Human Services deadline. Am I correct in stating that?
That's correct.
So we have our hands tied a little bit to the extent that we – if we're going to pass this, and obviously people can vote yes or no on the bill itself, whether here, other committees, or on the floor, but for those folks who would like to see it passed, we do have that deadline. So my intent would be to take action today, whether this morning or this evening – on the bill.
Well, Mr. Chair, if we have a March 31st deadline, why not at least wait until March 1st and we have the February forecast out?
The difficulty we have is that there's going to be another committee that's come up. It would have to go to the Rules Committee from this committee because of language added relative to legislative oversight, if I'm not mistaken. We would then have, obviously, the bill on the Senate floor. The expectation is, given the complexity of the bill, that there would be a conference committee. Am I correct in stating that, Sir Lurie?
I keep telling Atkins he should concur, but he doesn't seem to agree.
Okay.
Mr. Chair,
Sir, you know, and then we have the Easter Passover break earlier this year of March 22nd, so we're not going to be around.
Mr. Chair, if we waited till March 1st to take action on this committee, at least we would know what realm we're operating in. We can move this through Rules Committee in a day. We can put it up on the floor the next day. We could have a vote on this first week of March. There is nothing in state law that says we have to recess over Easter. We're talking about real money here, and we're flying blind. I find that problematic. If nothing else, I want to make sure that that's on the record. I do have other questions specific to the bill, unless you want
sure.
to continue on this vein, Mr. Chair.
I always enjoy going back and forth with you, but go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and the feeling is reciprocal there. And Mr. Chair, going back to your other comments about the cleverness of the tax committee, I will do my darndest to bring some cleverness to this committee, if that pleases you, sir.
Good.
The fiscal note, we've got a lot of numbers in the budgetary costs. Maybe I missed it as I was going through because it's all numbers and there's not dollar signs in front of everything. But do we have a breakdown on participants in the exchange? Who, what the participation is going to be year by year? Do we have those numbers anywhere? Or if they're in the note, could you point, or in the fiscal note, could you point it to me?
It's in the mechanic.
Yeah. Starting on page 7 of the fiscal note are the low, medium, and high enrollment scenarios. And I mean, I will say too, this fiscal note, it is complicated, but if members are really interested, it is able to be, the assumptions are all there. You can step through it. It does take a fair amount of time, but it's time well spent if you're wanting to get behind it.
Yep. And that's what I was looking for. So that's helpful. I understand that's not so much of a fiscal impact of participation rate as it is the other things, but I was curious about the numbers. In the fiscal note, it indicates that our staff, and Senator Bonoff had a little bit of conversation on this line, that the staff on the exchange, their compensation varies quite a bit from other states lower. Why is that? Why are we making these assumptions? I think it's like half. What?
Half.
Is the salary, some of the salary ranges that were listed were.
That's a tail.
in a comparison to other states, that the salary ranges were not the same. They were significantly different.
I was saying what enrollees.
Yeah. Oh, sorry. why that big discrepancy? Maybe I was looking at an old fiscal note. I do have notes from a previous version, so that may have been changed. I've got a few more questions, but they're not as pertinent as those. So unless something more drives some further questions, I do have a couple of amendments, Mr. Chair, but I can wait if someone else has any that they're wanting to offer.
Chair Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Lori, one of the things that we keep hearing is that the healthcare exchange has to be self-sufficient. And my concern is if we're using the health impact fee, which is basically general fund dollars, then it's not self-sufficient. It's supported by the general fund. And I'm not necessarily in favor of up to 3.5% tax on small businesses or individuals either, but my question for you is the current language with the health impact fee, how is the program self-sufficient if we're using general fund dollars? Because to me, Mr. Chair, self-sufficient means it pays for itself, but in this case, it is certainly not paying for itself.
Mr. Chair, Senator Miller, actually the manner in which the exchange certifies costs and has those funds transferred to them is the manner in which it is self-sustaining in the current version of the bill. And again, I mean, we can argue, you know, I mean, you said you don't like this version of the financing, but you don't like the 3.5% withhold either. I mean, and that's kind of the quandary we keep finding ourselves in. There is no way to finance this thing that meets everybody's desires. So we can have the conversation. It's in the jurisdiction of the committee, so amendments are proper. The manner in which this is crafted, with the exchange certifying the expenditures that they need to make that are necessary for operations, that's the manner in which it is self-sustaining in the current version of the bill.
And, Mr. Chair, just to follow up on some comments that we had earlier, and I had the question about full-time equivalents, whether it's large, medium, or low enrollment, and then I heard the testifier say that the customer service are there customer service FTEs that are not included in those numbers? So could this agency or department get larger than the 86 FTEs that are listed in the fiscal note?
Mr. Chair, Senator Miller, the customer service is largely that navigator in-person assister function and the call center operations and the interactions with individuals, helping them make sure that they can use these new tools that are available to them. And as there's it's done via a calculation of per member per month costs to provide that service. And at low enrollment, the per member per month is probably a higher enrollment, but when you multiply it by the enrollment, it's a lower number than if you get a high enrollment, you can drive the per member per month down for the overall costs, but it's going to be a bigger number just driven by the higher number of people that you multiply the per member per month by. So the changes in the fiscal estimates are large. That's the manner in which the fiscal estimates are driven by enrollment. You're providing services to a fewer number at lower enrollment scenarios, and you're providing assistance to more at the higher enrollment scenarios. And, of course, you do get some efficiencies as you get up there, and you can drive the cost per member per month down a little bit, but that's the interchange between those.
So, Mr. Chair, Senator Lori, could we see more than 86 FTEs, or are we not to exceed 86 FTEs?
The 86 FTEs is what's in here, and the numbers driven by the customer service would not affect the FTE count.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be brief. Just off of Senator Nienow's comments about moving along quickly here, I too was here when you, Mr. Chair, when you made the comments about basically how you didn't have a whole lot to say, or I don't like the word steamrolled, but we're taken over by the chair of the tax committee, or the tax committee when it comes to the funding mechanism for this bill. And I guess I'm wondering, too, in the fact that the 31st of March is an awful long ways away from here. I've heard you say when Senator Roebling was in control that the buck does stop here. I mean, this is the Finance Committee. And
I don't think I said that.
Oh, I think you said I think quite regularly you said that. So my point is, and I think it's very well stated that it does stop here. It does stop here, and under your guidance. And why would we just forge right ahead when we have time to look at other mechanisms here? That and getting past that next forecast would seem to make just good sense to those so many people out there that don't really make sense of this at all. I mean, the folks that we work for are the ones that pay the bills. So I would encourage this to carry forward. And at 6 o'clock tonight is a good time for me, so I'm just fine with that, by the way. But, no, I would see something after the forecast, having plenty of time.
Well, Senator Lurie, maybe I could have you address. I mean, a couple of members have asked questions about the calendar, and I've attempted to address that. But maybe you could offer a couple of comments. You've spent a lot of time with this bill, and you've been in front of a lot of committees as to what the timeline is or why the timeline.
Right. I can talk to the timeline. Let me also just say in general about the financing mechanism. You know, I mean, the forecast isn't going to change things dramatically. We need a self-sustaining funding mechanism. That's a federal requirement, and we had one that was the withhold that generated a lot of, you know, negative comments. We now have another one, but I mean, bottom line is if members have one they prefer, we can discuss it, but we should go ahead and do that. I don't see where it needs to slow us down. The reason for the March 31st deadline, the best way to describe it is to go and just work backwards from January 1, 2014. That's when these policies are going to be actually covering people's lives, and that's written in the statute, in the Affordable Care Act. That's not going to change unless Congress decides to change the law. And I don't think anybody anywhere on the spectrum believes that's a likely scenario. So we're stuck with January 1, 2014. We also have to have a three-month open enrollment period prior to that, which backs us up to October 1, 2013, this very year. And so the products have to be built by then. If you think about October 1, 2013, the March 31st deadline that we committed to in our blueprint submission to the feds back in November, the period between April 1st and October 1st is 6 months for our carriers in the state to design the products that will populate this exchange, have the plan submissions sent in to Commerce for approval, have the rate submissions sent to Commerce for approval. That's 6 months. You know, for a process that typically takes 2 years to design new plans and get them to the market. And so backing up from January 1, 2014, which is set in the law, to October 1, 2013, which is set in the law, and then giving the carriers the 6 months to develop the products that will populate that open enrollment period is something that we agreed to in our federal blueprint and that the feds have indicated clearly that they're going to hold us to. So that's where we get to the March 31st. It is in no way intended to stifle discussion. We've had an incredible length and breadth of discussions at several committees. This is stop number 8. You know, I need to go to rules later in the week due to an amendment we took on earlier. That's 9 committees. And we've had really, you know, I believe good conversations at each stop. And I welcome those conversations. We really have improved this bill at every single stop with the collaborative efforts of each committee. And I welcome that process, but it does need to happen in an abbreviated calendar timeline. We can spend, we'll come back at 6. It works for me too. But we agreed, and the feds are going to hold us to the March 31st.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you for that, Senator Lurie. And I think you basically made my point and agreed that we don't have the actual solutions, and that with what you, the chair, Senator Cohen, made comments with it, that this could possibly be slowed down until after the deadline. That seems to make good reason, good sense. This is very big legislation. It should take 8, 9, 10, 4, 15 different stops. It just seems to me, and I would really like to see the committee would like to see what your answer is after talking with the tax chair as to a funding mechanism, if it should change. So, your decision.
Well, there are ongoing conversations with the tax chairman, I can assure you that. Senator Nino.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and not to belabor the point, but I'm going to belabor the point. And Mr. Chair, this is not.
I'm sorry, I'm going to interrupt you for a second. I never said the buck stops here. I often do say belabor the point, though. I do want to point that out all the time.
This is not a. It's not because you're the chair, Mr. Chair. When I was vice chair of this committee, you saw me push back against my own chair when I thought things weren't being done the right way. And I don't think it's being done the right way. I think we have an obligation as a finance committee, when we're looking at a bill that's going to spend $120 million in the out years to going to create a hole in this current deficit, to take as much time as we need and yet still meet federal deadlines. I understand the deadline for the 31st if we're going to get this done. But we're not talking about – I'm not requesting that we come back on March 21st and give us 10 days. Let's just wait till the 1st. So that we have real numbers to work with, and Senator Lurie said that the forecast isn't going to change a lot. Number one, we don't know that. Number two, it very well might. We're looking at federal sequestration. That estimates may be 600,000 jobs nationwide. Some of those, of course, will be in Minnesota. That's going to affect tax revenue that's coming into the state of Minnesota. We don't know what those projections are going to be. There very well may be a significant change in the February forecast.
And Senator Nino, I think I expect a change in the forecast.
Yeah.
I don't think I expect a significant change. The reality is none of us know. I'm not sure the forecast makes any difference with this particular bill, though, one way or another. I don't know if it's fair to
put. That was my point, is that, we need a financing mechanism. Is it general fund? Is it the 3.5% withhold? It's not that the forecast isn't going to change. Of course, we don't have the forecast before us.
Mr. Chair, with the bill in its current form, it makes a big difference because this bill creates a hole in the general fund. That's what we spend here. If it was a withhold, I would absolutely agree with you. If it was a premium tax, I would agree with you because that's not going to affect our general fund budget. But this bill affects the general fund budget. And this committee has a responsibility to exercise its full oversight, and I don't think we're going to do that if we move this bill out before the February forecast.
Yeah. Senator Goodwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I want to just make a point that the ACA passed in 2010, and for the last 2 years when you had the majority, Senator Lurie was trying to get hearings on this issue, and he was not given hearings. We could have had a lot more discussion on this, but I also – in addition to that, I want to say that this is Senate File 1. It's been here since the very beginning of this legislative session. It's gone through 9 committees, 6 times I've heard it. This is the 7th time. There's very few of us, maybe Senator Sieben, that it's her first time hearing it. But other than that, I think that it has gone through, and it was there, and people could examine it, and people could go to the committees. And Senator Lurie has been more than any author I've ever seen been up for talking to people and negotiating and putting things in after working on this himself for the last 2 full years. So if you don't have enough time, you better look at who's to blame for that, because we could have had a lot more time had those hearings been held.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you. Well, I guess we can go back and forth, tit for tat, who was in control and who wasn't. The bottom line is the chairman made the comment right away very strongly that he was concerned about the funding mechanism. If it wasn't for that comment, I don't think the discussion goes on. Very concerned about if we're going to be taking it from the right source of revenue. And we should be. That's, again, the buck does stop here, and I'm part of that process. So,
Senator Nino.
Hey, Mr. Chair, the woulda, coulda, shoulda is irrelevant. We're here where we're at. But if you want to talk about looking at the bill, this bill has changed quite a bit from when it was introduced. And I have sat in on other committees. I've been in on at least
some of maybe half of the different committees. The most recent committee, because the bill was nearing its final form, Senator Lori can attest. I sat over there and I sat over here and I listened in on most of the committee. I was bouncing back and forth between K-12 because I have an interest in this piece of legislation, and I knew that I was going to be sitting here taking a look at it and in the Finance Committee, and I felt a strong responsibility to pay attention to what's going on with this, policy notwithstanding. Love it, hate it, whatever, but we need to figure out what the right thing to do is, and I'm troubled, and I'm going to make this my last comment on this topic, Mr. Chair. I do want to come back to a previous question, but I'm troubled that we are fast-tracking it without the best numbers, knowing that we could wait to get the best numbers and still meet the deadline. We could do that, absolutely, and that's just bothersome to me, Mr. Chair. But unless someone else wants to comment on that, I will go back to a previous question.
All right, let me just make it clear to members that I've been told that there's a joint Senate-House committee coming here afterwards. It's a matter of some controversy. They need time to get the committee ready. We've got about 5 minutes. So I want to – are there amendments, motions?
Make a motion.
Senator Goodwin?
I'll make a motion that
I have one – well, go ahead. Make a motion. We'll pick it up later.
Senator Goodwin?
That we recommend the bill to pass.
All right. Senator Goodwin's motion. Is there further discussion?
Well, Mr. Chair.
Senator Nino.
I mentioned earlier that I do have a couple amendments, and I would wait for further discussion and amendments. So I do have those.
This is the time for amendments, if you can offer amendments.
I do have those, and I do have, at least the question that I asked previously. I do have a clarification on that. I found the information that I've been looking at in the fiscal note, and I would like to ask that question again, if I may, Mr. Chair.
Certainly. But Senator Lori, did you – I'm not sure between you and Senator Nino. I'm not sure who was first. So,
I defer to the author, Mr. Chair.
Well, we can no. Go ahead, Senator.
Senator Nino.
Well, Mr. Chair, previously I'd asked a question about compensation and there being a discrepancy in. I'd seen it, but I couldn't remember the details. It is on page 9 of the fiscal note, the second to the last paragraph. It references the 50% lower salary rates, and I was wondering how we came to those assumptions. Why is that? And in particular, because in the fiscal note it says if the staff were to be on par with other states, we're talking $1 million more in costs. So it's not an insignificant amount.
Mr. Chair, Senator Nino, I think if you go into the chart and look, I think they used that 108 that you'll see salary for a lot of the senior members. I believe that's the governor's salary, and that's something that, has historically been used. But in this bill, we allow salaries above that in order to attract the best people. And other states have been through this and have offered their senior-level staff for their exchanges something higher than that 108. So for populating the tables, they used the governor's salary. And for the text, they recognized that exchange boards that have been created have decided to pay senior-level staff more than what is in those charts.
Mr. Chair, we've now segued into another what I think is going to be lengthy series of questions. Are we out of time?
Well, we're pushing it.
Well, I'll continue if you like, Mr. Chair. Senator Lori, now we're coming back to the entire structure of the exchange and the exchange board. And these are some concerns that I brought up in the policy committee, but now we have it tied to fiscal concerns. For those that aren't intimately familiar with the bill, we have board members that are appointed and confirmed by the Senate, at which there is essentially no more direct accountability. We have a legislative advisory commission or committee or something, but they have no authority to take any action. They can ask questions, and they can make some recommendations to the legislature, but that is the end of their power, unless I'm misunderstanding that, Senator Lori. And so here we have a fiscal note that says we're paying these people half of what other states are, and we give explicit power to this board to set salaries. And as I mentioned earlier,
they set their budget, of course, based on salaries and overhead. They set their budget, they certify it, and then the commissioner just pulls the money right out of the fund and gives it to them before the health impact fee money is sent into the general fund. So they get their money before the legislature gets its oversight on that funding. We don't make them an appropriation. They just get their money. And so at least the way I hear the testimony, basically we should assume that these people are going to get paid more money than what's really in the fiscal note.
Mr. Chair, Senator Nienau, it's not half. It's 50% more. That's fine. So two-thirds. And I was corrected. It's 95% of the governor's salary is what they pegged in there. But it should be made clear these are not the salaries of the board members. The board members are at the $30,000 that for 2 years, now sunsetted. And the board is to take a look at what the right salary is and send those recommendations over to the Legislative Coordinating Commission, and then they come to the legislature for approval before they're actually enacted. And that's why they left in the charts the 95% of the governor's salary. But they did, you know, to their credit, take note that through this process that does include the LCC and the legislature, other states have looked at this, and in order to attract the talent that it's going to take to make this exchange work, other states have come to the decision that they probably need to be paid more than that level. And so they acknowledged that in the text, and it is to be seen there, but it is not without legislative oversight that would occur.
Mr. Chair, my larger point is that we have a fiscal note that's making some assumptions that are lowballed, for lack of a better term, acknowledging that when other states have had to do this, they haven't been able to pay these salaries. And if we really were going to meet reality, it's going to cost us $1 million more. And I'm assuming that's annually. Maybe it's in the biennium. I don't want to say disparaging things, but really? And this is the fiscal note that we have in front of us. And as Senator Miller alluded to earlier, it's 47 pages long, and he's new to this, and wow, that's confusing. What else is in here where there's $1 million here, $1 million there that maybe we're missing? And it actually goes back to my point of maybe we would do well to slow this down here in the Finance Committee so that we really know what we're doing and what we're acting on. Mr. Chair, unless there's more comment on that, I can just leave it there.
Okay. And how many amendments, how many more amendments do we have?
I have two, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
Point of order.
And Senator Pappas has an amendment. Senator Engelbertson?
Is it not a table higher than the motion that's on the floor? So I'd move to table it.
No, we're not going to do that. But I've been told by the sergeant's office, if you can, I'm going to ask you to withdraw the amendment or the motion. The sergeant's office has told me that our time is up, and that we.
So the buck doesn't really stop with us, then,
Mr. Chair. Well,
don't just. Chair, I'm just kidding.
Senator Engelbertson does have a motion on the floor.
Fair enough. We have Senator Engelbertson's motion to table, which is non-debatable. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
Motion fails.
Division.
Thank you, Mr.
Division?
Chair.
Okay, division has been requested. All those in favor, raise your hand.
Pretty loud.
All those opposed. Okay, on a vote of 7-11, motion fails. And Senator Fischbach, you're right in terms of Senator Engelbertson's motion, but the results can be the same. The sergeant's telling us.
Mr. Chair, though, really, whatever the outcome may be, when there is a motion on the floor, you can't just ignore it.
I'm acknowledging you're correct, Senator Fischbach. But the sergeant's telling us that we've reached the end of our time. They need the committee room. And so we'll recess now and come back at 6 o'clock.
Here?
Yeah, to this room.